Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Last time I gave a talk here, I was talking about the way that we change unskillful mental states, particularly repetitive, compulsive thoughts that take us to misery. And if we want to change those thoughts, those patterns in the mind, that we have to do two things. We have to refrain from feeding those thoughts, but we also have to actively cultivate thoughts that lead us to happiness. We have to change the balance or the ratio of those thoughts in the mind. And the simile I gave was that it's like having a glass jar that's full of different coloured marbles or jelly beans. And if we have lots of blue jelly beans which represent misery, then even if we start to take some of those out and we've only got a few of jelly beans of different colours, red, yellow or white ones which represent happiness or enjoyment or qualities which bring us enjoyment of our life, that even if we take out a lot of the blue ones but we don't put any new ones in, that there'll still be more blue ones, and that it's more likely that every time we reach into the jar we'll take out the blue one. So it's not enough to refrain from just putting the blue ones in and then taking them out. We've got to increase the number of other coloured beans in there, the wholesome states, if we want to start to change the colour of our mind. Now, after I gave that talk, someone came and asked me very seriously, what are the wholesome things that we need to put in to our mind? Because they had really no idea of what we're talking about when we're talking about these wholesome states. And we can talk about them in theory and say, well, wholesome states are those which don't cause us suffering now or in the future. But they wanted something more specific. They wanted to know exactly what we were talking about. And so tonight I'd like to talk about some of the ways in which we can identify those wholesome states and how we can develop them, and how the Buddha's teaching helps us to do that. It's very important to know at the beginning, though, or to be aware of the fact that we're not talking about things in theory. Each one of us has to find out for ourselves whether it's true that developing these wholesome states actually leads to our happiness. We're not talking about just a moralistic view of ourselves as we should be good people, and then we'll be happy, or then we'll be okay. That's not the way that the Buddha's path works. The Buddha's path works through investigating for ourselves from our own experience what truly leads to our happiness and what leads to our suffering. And one of the very well-known suttas, which is often quoted to help us to investigate in this way, is the Kalama Sutta, which is often given the title the Buddha's Charter of Free Inquiry, in which the Buddha says, don't believe things just because I've said it. Don't believe it just because it's the tradition. Don't believe it just because it seems reasonable. But test it out for yourself. See whether if you put this into action, if you do it in your life, it makes a difference. And particularly in this situation, if it leads to more happiness. Now, many people quote that sutta, but they often don't appreciate that in that sutta itself, the Buddha actually recommends that people try out certain things to see. He doesn't just leave it open altogether. He says, try out and see if you cultivate these, and he gives a name to some of these wholesome states, the four Brahma Viharas, or the four boundless states. And you may be familiar with these, metta, loving kindness, which is an attitude of friendliness and goodwill towards ourselves and others. Karuna, compassion, the sincere wish to be free of suffering ourselves and to wish others in the same way to be free of suffering. Mudita, or happiness in the happiness and success of others. And upekkha, equanimity, the ability to maintain the balance of our mind through the ups and downs of life. And these are four of the wholesome qualities that the Buddha recommends that we try out for ourselves and investigate to see whether they lead to our happiness, to our greater happiness. And in order to approach these four wholesome states, we need to have some sort of understanding of the fact that when we're talking about them, we're not talking about making other people more important than we are and cultivating loving kindness or compassion for others at our own expense, at putting ourselves down as not being so important, not being so worthy of care and attention. It's not the idea of going out and doing these things for other people and neglecting ourselves. Our own well-being is so caught up with our own state of mind and then what we put out to others, because that's what we'll get back. But the understanding is that we have to have that quality in our heart in order to give it out. And we need to develop it first of all towards ourselves, otherwise we don't have it to give out. Now, one of the interesting things that you might discover as you try to explore your relationship with, say, loving kindness, metta, is that it's actually hard to generate it towards yourself. That you don't easily have a feeling of friendship or goodwill towards yourself. You might be able to have that feeling towards someone that you care about, someone that you're close to, but it doesn't come so easily for yourself. And as we investigate these states, we recognize that. That's one of the things that we're discovering. And then we discover that if we don't have it towards ourselves, then that's one of the sources of misery in our life. And so how can we develop it when we see that it's missing? And there are particular systematic meditations that we can do to help us to cultivate these states of mind. So, for example, if we're trying to develop loving kindness, a feeling of warmth and softness towards ourselves, then we try to think about what we would wish for ourselves. What would be a genuine wish for our well-being? And so one of the standard phrases that we might come up with is, may I be well and happy, or may I know peace, or may I be patient May I be more accepting of my life, whatever would help us to soften our heart to ourselves. And if we start to practice this systematically, we would, in our meditation, repeat those phrases to ourselves. First of all, just to get some approximation to those good wishes. But what we're trying to cultivate is not just the thought of goodwill, but the actual feeling of goodwill in our heart. And if we try to do that towards ourselves and we can't generate that warmth, the actual emotion of a loving feeling towards ourselves, then the way that we proceed with this meditation is to bring to mind someone in our life for whom we can easily have those kinds of feelings. Someone who's been a teacher, maybe someone who's a relative or a friend, not someone that we're passionately involved with, not someone that we're have a mixed relationship with, but someone that we can easily bring them to mind and have that sort of warmth. So it may be someone who's not even in our life at the moment. It could be someone from the past, perhaps a teacher or a neighbour, someone who's been a mentor. And when we bring that person to mind, and in the meditation we can visualise their face, we may even repeat their name, we can easily feel that emotion of goodwill, of warmth, of friendship. And we wish for them what we know or what we presume would be helpful for them to express that feeling of warmth. So may they be well and happy. May they be at peace. And as we offer that wish to them, then it may be possible, as we repeat it, that we do start to feel the emotion of goodwill. And if we're doing this in a systematic way, we keep doing that until the feeling comes up. And then when that feeling is generated, we switch back to ourselves and wish for ourselves. May I be well and happy. May I be at peace. Whatever it is that we feel would be appropriate. And then we investigate to see whether the feeling that we can generate for that other person is there for ourselves. And it may take some time repeating the same phrases in different meditation sessions for those feelings to actually be generated, to be actually in touch with them. And then as we move from ourselves to the person that we can easily feel those feelings towards, the next category of people that we can wish those feelings for is a good friend. And a good friend may be someone who we're involved with in our life now, or it can be again someone from our past, but someone whom we can easily have those kinds of warm feelings towards. But if they're a friend that we're actively involved with right now, we might find that there is some mixture. Even though they're a good friend, we may have days when we don't see eye to eye. And so we investigate the effect that that has on the loving feeling in our mind. And we keep repeating the phrases that we feel would be appropriate until we can generate the actual feeling or emotion of loving kindness. And then again we come back to ourselves, to the person that we can easily have those feelings towards, and then we bring up our good friend. And then the next category that we move towards, if we're trying to cultivate these meditations in a systematic way, is to start to offer these kinds of feelings to what we call the neutral people in our life. And these are people that we see that are part of our everyday experience, but that we don't have close relationships with. So the people that we see maybe every day on the bus, at the shopping centre, maybe even people in our office that we don't have direct connection with, they're part of our world, they're part of our life, but we don't know them intimately. They're not connected to us directly, but in an indirect way. And we try to extend our loving feelings to include those people as well, wishing for them what we would wish for ourselves. May they be well and happy. May they be at peace. Whatever conditions we think would be appropriate. And we keep practicing bringing those people to mind and trying to generate that loving feeling towards them. And then after we have been able to generate the feeling towards that group, towards ourselves, towards a good friend, towards someone we can easily have those feelings, towards a good friend, and then towards those people who we consider neutral, then we can try to generate loving feelings towards someone that we consider that we're not on good terms with. The label for this group is the enemy, but it doesn't have to be someone that we have a tremendously hateful relationship with, just someone that we're not on good terms with. Maybe we have a conflicted relationship with these people. Maybe we've got some unfinished negative business with them. And so we bring them to mind and we wish, as we would for ourselves, for our friends, what we think would be helpful for this person. And we keep on repeating the phrases until we can feel the emotion in our heart. Now, this may take months of practice to move through these different categories and to be able to generate the feeling in the heart. And what we recognize as we do this is that it may be beneficial for the people that we're visualizing or that we're thinking about, but the person who benefits first of all is we ourselves, because what we're doing through this practice is we're growing a bigger, stronger, more open and loving heart. And that bigger, stronger, more open, loving heart is a protection for us. It's a gain for us. It brings happiness into our life. It brings strength of mind. It makes us much less vulnerable to the slights and difficulties that we experience in daily life. It makes us much more balanced in our approach to things because we have this inner protection, we have this inner strength, we have this inner resource which we're growing day by day. And we find ourselves with a much less sticky mind. Things that previously would have irritated us and stayed with us and kept coming back and found a place to nest in the mind, those things just roll off. They don't stay. They don't stick. And the things that we would have in the past considered too much effort, too difficult, I can't face that, it's too hard, those things we find we can meet the challenge with much more easily, because our own heart, our own mind has grown stronger, more energized, more stable through the practice that we're doing in generating loving kindness for ourselves and others. And this is really what we have to find out for ourselves, because otherwise all of these words like loving kindness, friendliness, strength of mind, they don't really mean anything. They're just concepts. They're just theories. And the actual experience of it can't really be conveyed in words. It's only an approximation of how it actually feels in the heart and what it actually adds to our life. And as we cultivate loving kindness as the basis for this feeling of goodwill, so that we can develop not only goodwill towards people generally, but also identify how our hopes and aspirations for ourselves are so similar to the hopes and aspirations that others have for themselves, for their loved ones, for their families. And just as we wish to be happy, so they wish to be happy. Just as we wish to avoid harm and be free of pain, so they wish to be free of pain and avoid harm. And so from the basis of goodwill, compassion arises. We see that the suffering of others is no different from our own suffering, and the way that it hurts others is the way that it hurts us. And so as we wish to be free of suffering ourselves, we can generate the sincere wish that all beings may be free of suffering. And from this sincere wish, we may then be motivated to see how can I help alleviate some of the suffering that's apparent in the world. If I know that I don't want to suffer in that way, and I understand others don't want to suffer in that way, what can I do in my daily life to actually help to alleviate suffering? And so we can actually generate not only the wish in our heart, but the inspiration to go and do something active in our life to help others. And to have this feeling of connection with others, both in ordinary life but also in the difficulties of life, then can help us to recognize that just as we love to have success and happiness, and we love the people close to us to have success and happiness and good health and whatever else that we enjoy, so it is for everyone else in the world. Just as we feel, so they feel. And instead of feeling threatened by the happiness and success of others, we can actually start to take active delight in the well-being of others. Now, how this starts to open up is when we see more and more deeply how interconnected we all are. How if someone suffers, we also suffer. We may not even know the people on the other side of the world who've just been caught in a flash flood or a mudslide or fire or whatever it is, but we can put ourselves in their shoes and think, I wouldn't like that to happen to me. And just by having that knowledge of their suffering and just being touched by it, we're already connected to them. Even though we may never know the details of their life, we are connected even just mentally. And if we go out and do something to be of service and to help them to alleviate their suffering, then that's another connection. We start to see that what's happening around us does affect us. And so then we can switch that and start to enjoy the good fortune of others, not as something that undermines our happiness or robs us of the possibility of success, but as something that we can actually share in, that we also can enjoy. If we celebrate along with them, that celebration in our heart makes our own heart happier, stronger, brighter. And this is not something that's easy to do, because very often what comes up when we see someone else's success is a feeling of jealousy, a feeling of, if they have that happen to them, it may reduce the chances it'll happen to me. We just investigate these things, start to see, is that true? Pay attention to what comes up first when we hear about our friend's success. Can even be people that we know, that we are supposedly close to, that we find feelings of jealousy, rivalry arising in the mind. And this is for us just to know what is produced, and then to see how it doesn't actually make for our happiness. It doesn't make for our well-being. It actually drains us of happiness and energy. And so then we see that it's for our own well-being to try to cultivate this ability to celebrate the success of others, to be joyful in their happiness along with them. Because that happiness in our own heart is what is beneficial for ourselves. And the more that we widen the circle of the people that we are able to feel compassion for and also celebrate with, the less vulnerable we become to the ups and downs of life. When we focus all our attention on a very narrow circle, our own family, our own friends, we invest a lot of time and energy in trying to protect them from the things that are likely to cause harm, cause suffering. And we all know as we go through life that that's not possible, that things will come that are unwanted. Things will happen that will cause suffering. And it's impossible to protect the ones that we love, the ones that we give all our time and attention to, from those difficulties. But if we can start to see that these are difficulties that we all share, this is part of the human condition, this is what happens to everyone in life, then it starts to take away some of the fear that we feel. How will we cope when that happens? What would we do if that happened? How would we try to stop it happening? What ends would we go to just to make our own loved ones safe and protected? That sort of very self-centered, self-cherishing approach to life brings a lot of suffering, because it's an impossible ask to try and keep away all the things that upset us, cause harm. Even just thinking about how easy it is for our health to be affected, ill health to come, sickness which may become chronic, which may not be with us, we may not be able to get rid of, to cure, may be with us for the rest of our life, may affect someone in our family. This kind of suffering is just everywhere. And if we start to open our heart to that and see that other people suffer the way we do, other people go through the difficulties that we might be facing, that can really help to halve our suffering. We have the situation that we need to deal with, perhaps ill health, but we don't get caught up in the mental anguish that goes with resisting it, thinking it's not fair, fighting against, why should this happen to me? If we've opened our heart widely to the fact that all others are in the same boat, and if we've practiced at standing in others' shoes, putting ourselves in their place and feeling what it's like, how we would feel in that situation, then when unwanted things come into our own life, we're protected from that self-centered mental anguish which thinks this shouldn't happen to me. Of course, this doesn't come easily. It takes a lot of practice. And as I was saying, if we even just try to systematically cultivate loving kindness as a meditation, it can take us months just to get to the point where we can feel that warm feeling towards ourselves and the people that we already are close to, those that are our dear friends, those are the people that we can easily have those feelings towards, let alone the people who are outside our circle or the people who are our enemies. So this is a practice that is not just something that we do once, we do it again and again. And as we do it, we encounter the barriers. These are called the boundless states, because what they try to do, their aim, is to break down the barriers that we establish between ourselves and others. The idea that only I'm important, or only this group is important, or if I look after this group of people, everything else will be all right. We know that's not true. we look after this group, but if that group is suffering, then often it has a direct effect on us. This is very obvious in the world of terrorism that we live in today. We can see that we might be happy in our little corner of the world, but because people in another corner of the world aren't happy with their situation or aren't happy with the way that we live our lives here, that leaves us in a place of conflict. And so as we extend our boundaries, it's not that we're going to make these difficulties go away, but we're going to make ourselves, our mind, more able to deal with them. Now, I had a very good example of this recently. Someone who, since the last time I was down here and gave a talk, has actually died as a result of having a very severe illness, which was very painful at times. And, of course, brought a lot of distress, but to that person and to the people close to her, as she particularly entered the last weeks of her life. But one of the lessons that she taught me was how the development of these Brahmaviharas as wholesome states of mind throughout one's life can provide a wonderful protection and support even in the most drastic of circumstances. And we'd probably all say that the facing an incurable illness and facing our death is probably the most drastic circumstances that we can think about. Now, in this person's case, she had cultivated a very rich life, a life of many very deep relationships, friendships, relationships with family. It wasn't a life that was one in which she withdrew from contact in order to look after herself. She really was a person who put a lot of love, a lot of care, a lot of time and energy and effort into her relationships. And because of her ability to open up to other people in a very deep way and to really look at what they needed, what would make them comfortable in that situation, what are they going through now, what would be really helpful for them. She was able again and again throughout the course of her life to put herself in other people's shoes and to feel their suffering, but also to celebrate their joys as though they were her own. And she didn't call this Buddhist practice or I'm developing the Brahmaviharas. She just lived her life that way. And she was a very happy, joyful, energetic person, sort of person who could in the middle of things and enjoyed her life immensely. Now, when she came to the experience of having a very painful illness and having to endure months of painful treatment, very often she would use her experience of her big heart and her deep connection with others to put her own illness in perspective. And she would say things like, when things were difficult, and say she couldn't go out and she was stuck at home because she was too sick to go out or to do anything, she would say, now this must be like Auntie so-and-so felt when she was sick and at home and stuck inside all the time. And because she could remember that someone else had gone through the experience, it halved her suffering at that moment. And when she was experiencing pain, which was not alleviated by any of the medication that she was able to have, and she had to just bear with that pain, she would say things like, you know, this is how the Jessie, the little dog that we had, must have felt when she was having that cancer that we couldn't do anything about in the last months of her life. This must be like the pain she felt. And she would put her own pain in perspective by remembering that even the little dog had had to endure this kind of pain. She was able to constantly reduce her mental anguish around what she was experiencing and thereby bear with the difficulties that she was going through by constantly moving out from her self-centered view of things to put herself in others' shoes. And that was a great support for her. It was actually very inspiring to see how she managed, and to be with her just in the last few days of her life, and to know that she died with great peacefulness of mind. Even though she'd lived a very full life and she had had so much richness there, she was actually able to let go of her attachments. As her physical condition deteriorated and her world shrunk, she was no longer able to go out. She was no longer able to go upstairs. She was no longer able to go out to the family room. She was no longer able to go out of her bedroom. She was no longer able to get out of bed. As her world shrank, even though she had had so many rich relationships, so many projects on the go, as her world shrank, she let go because she lived them fully while she was able to. Now she no longer was able to do that, she just let them go. And as her world shrank, her heart got bigger and bigger. Even though the things that she was involved with, the people that she was close to, she also had to let go of. And she died very peacefully. She's a wonderful object lesson, really, to what this practice can bring about. Because very often we have a perception or a view of Buddhist life of having to be one where we pull ourselves in from life. We don't get too involved, so we don't get too attached. Because then we suffer when our attachments are broken. But that's because we often are thinking about our selfish attachments, the things that we need, the things that we want, the people that we're close to, the people that are important to us. And those are the attachments that do bring suffering when we have such a narrow view of the world and our place in it. But when we have this big heart, when we have this richness, when we spread ourselves far and wide, but deeply, not superficially, but deeply, then that rich life is a wonderful life for ourselves and for others as well. And then as it comes to the time when we can no longer physically go out and enjoy that richness, we have that enduring memory of those relationships, of what we've done, how we've engaged with other people, not just the people close to us, not just our family, our friends, but with the world at large. We have that richness still in our heart, and that becomes our refuge. That becomes the place that we can return to, even when we can't move any further than our bed. This is what provides a space to rest in when the physical body is really falling apart. That's where the mind can find peace. Now, if it can do that in the most desperate conditions, then it can also do that, it can learn to do that, it can be trained to do that in the middle of our busy life, when we're still out there doing the things that we're doing. And that's what this cultivation of wholesomeness promises us. If we cultivate these wholesome states, and I've just mentioned the four Brahma Viharas, there are many more wholesome states which the Buddha explicitly mentions. Things like generosity, things like patience, energy, truthfulness. If we start to actively cultivate those wholesome states in our day-to-day life, we'll find that they do lead to happiness. They allow us to live free of anguish, free of worry, free of remorse. And they help us to connect from a place that is much less self-centered than the way that we usually engage with life. If we just take one of those qualities like truthfulness, and we see how the whole of this path helps us to cultivate a quality like that. We have, as you would be aware, as the heart of the Buddha's teaching, the Four Noble Truths. So what we're trying to approach in this practice is to see things as they really are and to be able to see them in a less self-centered way. That's what these Four Noble Truths are telling us, that the cause of our suffering is because of our self-centeredness. Now, when we try to cultivate truthfulness in our life so that we can start to be more in touch with reality and the way things are, tell things as they are, we have the support of the five precepts, one of which is to cultivate speech which is honest, speech which is truthful, speech which is kind, speech which actually helps our relationships. And as we cultivate being scrupulously honest, it's not only a matter of not telling lies, it's about telling the truth, telling the whole truth and nothing but the truth, telling the whole story, even when it might put us in a bad light, not telling the parts of the story that we want people to know about and telling it in a way that gives the wrong impression. Now, as we try to cultivate truthfulness, and as we commit ourselves to keeping this precept, it helps us to see where we try to cut corners and what that does to our mental peace. Does it actually bring happiness, or does it bring more confusion and worry into our life? And if we're trying to be kind, if we're trying to put ourselves in other people's shoes, how does not telling the truth interfere with doing that? How is it? How do we feel when people lie to us? How do we tell a real friend from a false friend? Very often we tell them by whether or not we can trust them. So whether they tell the truth, whether they can be relied on. If we have a good friend that we can rely on, it brings peace of mind. If we're the sort of friend that people can rely on, that produces wonderful relationships. So we see how just cultivating this one quality, like truthfulness, affects so many areas of our life, but also how the different aspects of the path of practice help us to address the cultivation of this wholesome quality. And if we're thinking about trying to have a feeling of happiness in the success of others, and we're paying attention to what really comes up in our mind, whether it's envy or jealousy or irritation or whatever, then we need to be truthful. We need to be honest, honest with ourselves. And if we've started to be honest with ourselves, then we know where we stand. It's not a surprise. We can start to examine and be in touch with the way things really are. Does that jealousy actually make me feel good, or does it make me feel bad? How do I feel when people are jealous of me, or people are jealous of the things that my children succeed in, or my partner does well? How does it feel when I know that people are jealous and not wishing me well? And so we can see how just to be honest with ourselves, and then using that to help us investigate our experience, opens us up to seeing more clearly the way things are. which is what we're trying to do through this whole path of practice. So the cultivation of wholesome states is something which is beneficial first of all for ourselves. It's something which we need to cultivate continuously as we start and as we continue to develop this path. It's not enough just to stop doing the things which hurt ourselves and hurt others. We have to add to our life, if you like, value add to our life by deliberately cultivating what is going to bring happiness into our life. And these are the qualities. I've just given a few. This path is a path which doesn't focus on the negative. It focuses very much on the positive, on the things that help us. And if you start to practice any of these qualities, if you actively try to cultivate them, even if you just try to keep the five precepts, you will come in contact with and be opened up to all of these other positive qualities which help us to live more at peace with ourselves and more in harmony with others. And it's only the happy mind, the peaceful mind, the strong mind, which can go on to develop deep insight, liberating insight into the nature of reality. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of us, and may it help us all to attain Nibbana. Does anyone have any comments or questions? Thanks, Mary. So there's so much more to explore in all of these things, especially with the Brahma Viharas, but I would encourage all of you at least to take a look at them. They are integral to the path. They're not just a side issue. And actually, once you start to explore them and explore the Buddha's teaching further, you'll find that he mentions them in relation to insight as well as in relation to making the mind more peaceful. So tonight we've only just touched the surface, but I do encourage all of you to look further into them. So now if there are no more... The third precept is not to engage in sexual misconduct, which has at its basis not interfering in established relationships, whether those relationships are relationships of marriage or people living together without marriage, whether it's a same-sex relationship or a heterosexual relationship. It's not to interfere in established relationships and not to engage in sexual expression which causes harm to oneself or others. So it would include things particularly like child pornography, incest, rape, any of those kinds of behaviours. They're the most gross ones. But the more that you refine your mind, the more you'll see that even pornography of any kind is exploitative and harmful to oneself and others. And so the positive correlate of that, if we're trying to see the positives in this path, is to think of, first of all, making promises and keeping them. So if you're in a partnership with someone, that you've made a promise to that person to be in that partnership. So to keep your promises, to be someone who can be relied on. If you say you're going to do something, you do it. No one has to wonder whether you're actually going to turn up when you say you'll turn up or give the help that you say you're going to give or whatever it is. You're a person of your word. And the other aspect of it is to develop contentment with what we have. So sexual infidelity often arises because we're looking at someone else or what someone else has, and there's jealousy that someone has that, or that there's a comparison that this, what they've got, is better than what I've got, and we'd like to have something better. So there's a lack of contentment with what we already have. And again, as we go through the development of this path and understanding the nature of craving itself, whether it's sexual desire or desire for power or desire for material prosperity, we understand that we can never come to the end of craving by feeding craving, because we'll always want something else. And you can see this just through your own experience of how you think, if I just need to have this, something to eat or drink or whatever it is, and you have it, and temporarily you're satisfied. If it was true that you could end craving by giving in to craving, then you'd never want to eat or drink again. You'd eat or drink just because you have to keep the body alive, but you'd never have that, oh, I want to go out and have this, or I'm looking forward to doing that. The craving would be finished because you fed it, but it's never finished by feeding it. It's like a bottomless pit. The only way to overcome craving is to not crave. And the only way that we can start to uproot craving is to challenge it, and so not to give in to desire. And part of the payoff of these Brahma Viharas, particularly, one of the ways in which the Buddha encourages us to see their usefulness and their value, is that as we make our own inner life better, happier, our mind more peaceful and calm, we no longer look for satisfaction or completion in the things of the world. We have more inner contentment. That's one of the payoffs of the cultivation of loving kindness, compassion, happiness and the success of others, and equanimity. The inner feeling, the experience of it, is that one feels complete. One is content. And so one doesn't rush after or run after the things of the world or what someone else has, thinking, if I only had that, that would be enough. There's a very good book called, which I haven't read, but I love the title. It's called When Everything I Ever Wanted Wasn't Enough. Still wasn't enough. Enough to feel satisfied and complete. That's the basis of breaking the third precept. And so the positive quality that we develop is contentment. But it's all theory until you try it. You can only know for yourself by doing it. And that's what the Buddha encourages us all to do, to try it out and find out for ourselves. And wouldn't it be wonderful that if we try it out little by little, we don't have to be doing great things. We just keep trying and trying and trying. And then at the time when we need it most, when we're most in difficulty, we find we've got this inner resource, this inner strength that's there for us. We don't have to wait for someone else to do it for us or bring it to us or to solve our problem. There it is for us. And how wonderful that can be. So the payoff is for us, first of all, before it helps anyone else.
Arahant Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammam Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangham Namami.